www.mycom.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The problem on our country's southern border continues as unaccompanied children have come across that border in record numbers, fleeing violence in their native Central American countries. The president has called for money to deal with this influx of undocumented immigrants, but it seems that money at the moment is coming from funds earmarked for already established immigrant programs in other parts of the country, including our own. We're going to take a look at the local impact of this latest challenge to the United States immigration system this hour with three people who know that system well. Ellen Dubin is a Board of Immigration Appeals accredited representative and executive director of the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Sierra Ponce is director of the Catholic Charities Diocese of Charlotte Resettlement Program, one she became involved in first as a volunteer in 1981. Thank you for returning.
Thank you.
Good to see you. And Alan Gordon is a board-certified immigration specialist in accordance with the State Bar of North Carolina. That sounds very official. He practices immigration law in Charlotte and represents corporate and individual clients worldwide. Welcome back to you too, Alan.
Thank you, Michael.
And let me begin with you. Why this sudden influx, or it seems sudden to most of us, of unaccompanied minors coming across the border in the Southwest?
Well, it's been going on for years. I mean, the reason that we have a law that was made by President Bush back in 2008, and you'll hear the Republicans saying that Obama is the problem, but this law was made because there was a constant, every year there was thousands of kids coming across the border, unaccompanied minors, as they call them, and it's because of the situation in Central America, specifically Honduras and Guatemala, El Salvador. So
Was that what provoked President Bush to sign that law? Or?
That is correct, yes.
Okay, all right.
And the law was done so that the kids coming across would get the right to a hearing, and the hearing was to find out whether or not they had an actual asylum claim. So they found that a lot of them did, not all of them, but a lot of them, and a lot of them have very serious and tragic stories. So he said they'll be entitled to a claim. We're not going to rush them. And that was the humanitarian way to deal with it. Well, the only problem now is that the situation in Central America and those countries in particular has gotten worse. And countries like Panama and Nicaragua have picked up a lot of refugees. We're not the only ones. Mexico's picked up refugees. But now, you know, you see on TV, you see the kids on top of the trains, and you see them coming north into the United States border, and they are looking for safety, and they're looking for you know, survival.
So why is President Obama taking the rap for this?
Gee, Mike, it may have something to do with politics, but I'm not sure. It's just sad. You know, when they say that the immigration system is broken, and we've been saying that for years, we can say it, of course, about business immigration, but when it comes to this situation, everything gets politicized. So, you know, the Republicans, we haven't had a real meeting of the minds and come up with some immigration, comprehensive immigration reform. That's what we need for everything.
Now, most of us think because of news reports about this, and I'm told that after reading a lot of material yesterday that many people who know what you guys know believe or feel that the media doesn't understand the story and therefore misreports the story. And you just told me before we started, Ellen Dubin, that we have unaccompanied minor children who came here from elsewhere, undocumented, in Charlotte and throughout the state of North Carolina, and have for years. How many?
Well, just since October 1st, the estimate is approximately 1,100 have come to North Carolina, and of them, about 400 or 450 are here in Charlotte.
How do they get here? Those are the kids that have gone through the hearing process and have been sent here because they have relatives here or because somebody has volunteered to take care of them, or have they actually made their way from places like El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras through Mexico across our southern border and somehow got themselves to North Carolina?
It's my understanding that they have relatives here in Charlotte specifically or in North Carolina in general. Children, when they first arrive, are housed at the Border Patrol facilities for a maximum of 72 hours when they're screened. Then the Department of Homeland Security hands them over to the Office of Refugee Resettlement for placement with the Unaccompanied Minors Program, which might include foster care, living with a relative in the United States, or deportation back to the child's country of origin. The ones that are here now have joined relatives in the United States.
So 1,100 in North Carolina since October, and this, as you said, is not a new phenomenon. It's been going on for years, although we've had this uptick, this surge, I suppose is a good way to describe it, in the recent months. And according to Mother Jones, if you believe Mother Jones, 38,833 unaccompanied minors were apprehended by the Border Patrol last year. That was a 59% jump from the year before and a 142% increase from 2011. And some predict that 90,000 unaccompanied minors will cross our border this year alone. What's going on in the Central American countries that has gotten so much worse in recent years to cause this?
I'd say that the what I've read is that, you know, crime is on the upswing, gang violence is on the upswing, mafia-type violence, organized crime.
Why are they targeting children?
Well, they're the most vulnerable group to get. They've used the kids. They're using them for the sex trade. They're exporting them to the United States for that. So there's, and then locally, it's gone crazy. They're using them as a way to manipulate everybody. So they'll just threaten them and kill them.
I mean, we like to think of ourselves as the land of milk and honey and a place everybody wants to come. And maybe that alone makes this next question a stupid question. But why are they coming here? Why are they going north? Why don't they go south? Why don't they spread out throughout Central America? Why here?
Well, there are numbers on who's showing up and asking for asylum and getting asylum in Nicaragua, Panama, and Mexico. Mm-hmm. So they're not all, but they're coming here because, we are still the most attractive country in this hemisphere. And like I've said on previous shows, if it comes that people don't want to come here anymore, business people, family people, all people, then we should all be looking to see where we're going next time. So, we are the beacon. We are the beacon of freedom and safety, security, and we need to, we need to keep that. We need to foster that image, and we need to make sure that we have a system to take care of this. This is a humanitarian problem. This is not just an immigration problem.
Sarah, who are these kids, and how old are most of them?
The children are young. I've seen in reports they're as young as, 4 to 7-year-olds to young teens. So they're pretty young children.
And when a 4-year-old, when we say that a 4-year-old is an unaccompanied minor crossing from one of these countries into the United States, are they there with an older brother or sister, or are they 4 years old and on their own?
My understanding is sometimes there are siblings with them, or in some cases they're just traveling in groups.
Taking care of each other.
Families are paying coyotes, they're called, to smuggle them through the border. So there's an enormous amount of extortion that's going on as well.
On the part of the coyotes?
Yes.
And even when you pay them the money, there's no guarantee that they'll actually do what they say they're going to do. And a lot of people have died in the hands of these coyotes over the years, not just children, adults as well. Do most of these people, or do we know the answer to this question, do most of these children know where they're going once they get here? Do they know they have somebody here on the other side of the border that ultimately will either pick them up someplace at a predetermined location, or that they can make their way to somehow, someday?
It's my understanding that they do know. The very young ones I've read have like a label sewn into their clothing giving the name, address, and telephone number of a relative someplace in the United States.
And what have they been told to do? I mean, because most of these kids, I would presume, do not speak English. In an English-speaking country, they arrive here. What do they do? Take their shirt off and show somebody the tag? I mean, what's the plan? Do we know what the plan is for these kids? Do the kids know what the plan is?
I don't know.
What we're seeing at the border is that they're coming and they're asking for asylum. And so
that's why some of these kids are actually turning themselves over to the border guards.
Yeah, most of them. That's why there's thousands of them showed up at the border in June. During the American Immigration Lawyers Association conference, a lot of the Customs and Border Protection people couldn't be at the conference because they all went down to the Texas-Mexico border. So they're coming and they're saying, you know, save us. You know, we can't go back and we've made it this far, so please give us asylum. Now, the question is, what are we going to do with them? Yeah. How are we going to process them? How are we going to evaluate their situation?
Well, there's a lot of consternation and anger in the country about illegal immigration in the first place, and this is just like the cherry on top of the icing on top of the cake for a lot of people, and it's stirred a lot of emotion, particularly in Texas and Arizona, where they're bearing the brunt of the kids coming across the border, and they are the ones that are housing these young people, at least temporarily. But these children are fleeing not for economic opportunity, as many of their parents would have done. They're coming here out of fear for their lives. By definition, doesn't that make them refugees?
Well, at least makes them, you know, once they get here, we call them asylees. You know, they're asking for asylum. Mm-hmm. If we process them outside the United States, we call them refugees, but it's basically the same law. It's in the same group of laws. And so the question is, how do we process them? And then you look at the statute with regard to what is an asylee, and you see that they have to prove that they have a reasonable fear of persecution, and then the persecution has to be based on something that they can't change about themselves. Well, the courts have expanded that to include things like the children that have been the witnesses or the victims of sexual abuse or domestic violence, things like that. I mean, this actually happens. We actually see it in Charlotte. I mean, the people that are sitting at this table right now have seen and heard the stories. We did a case where a woman got here. I mean, it usually takes them over a month to get here by, you know, however they can get here from a Central American country. She got here with her son, who was about 7 or 8 at the time they made it here. But when, you know, she was a young woman who was married off to an older guy, and she was a horrible victim of sexual abuse and domestic abuse and assault. And so her son actually, when he was 5 or 6, saw his grandparents get murdered by his father. So they finally got out of their town, and they made it up to the United States. We asked for asylum for both of them. The law said that you have to ask for asylum within 1 year. So there's a time limit. You can't wait forever. And she had waited more than a year because it took her more than a year to get to North Carolina.
Mm. Now that, if I understand your story correctly, that has nothing to do with gang violence, which we are told many of these children are fleeing, although maybe the husband that she was married off to at a young age was a member of a gang. I don't know.
Right.
What about some of the stories that you have come into personal contact with, Ellen and Sarah? What are some of those kids' stories?
Well, what we're doing is we're working with United States Catholic Conference of Bishops to assist once the children have been released by the federal government to family members. When that occurs, we're able to provide, you know, an alternative to the detention and basically support the family reunification mm-hmm. that's going to take place wherever possible. So we're able to network with community and national groups as well to help these children and these families integrate into our community.
But that didn't answer my question, which was, tell me some of their stories. Who are these kids? What do they tell you when they get here? What have been their experiences that led them and their parents to allow them to make and push them toward making this, what is it, has to be described as the most perilous journey anybody could probably take? Maybe we'll get an answer to that question when we come back. We have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Diamonds Direct South Park, offering certified diamonds, more than 5,000 engagement ring mountings, pearls, and colored gemstones. Sharon Road across from South Park Mall, diamonds-direct.com. Maybe you saw the article from Danny Romine Powell in the paper this morning about Charlotte author Charlotte Muller, she finished her first book tour and ended up with more feedback on her looks than on her book. So she took matters into her own hands and lost 60 pounds, but more importantly, learned the value of feeling your best and owning your own looks. And as a result, she's written yet another book about it in which she shares that journey, and she'll share it with us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama is weighing an executive order to allow millions of undocumented immigrants to avoid deportation. Some Republicans say that would be grounds for impeachment. Debate over the constitutionality of executive orders.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the undocumented and unaccompanied minors who have been crossing our border in a great surge in the last couple of months from Central America, but it's been going on for years, almost 10 years, in drips and drabs and trickles. Ellen Dubin is with us, Executive Director of the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency, Sierra Ponce, Director of Catholic Charities of the Charlotte Diocese Resettlement Program, and Alan Gordon, an attorney who works in immigration law. And prior to the break, I asked the two people who deal with these kids directly to share with us some of their stories. And it turns out by the time they come to the Carolinas and get involved in these particular agencies, they're beyond telling their stories pretty much to these people. You're helping to find places for them to live and be safe. But you have heard some of the stories in the past. Can you summarize, just give me some basic kinds of situations that these kids are fleeing from?
I'm going to read the story of Kevin, a 17-year-old from Honduras. He reported, "My grandmother wanted me to leave. She told me, if you don't join a gang, the gang will shoot you. If you do join the gang, the rival gang will shoot you, or the cops will shoot you. But if you leave, no one will shoot you."
Hmm. Now, there are people living in American cities in that situation.
Right. There's people in Charlotte that have escaped that situation.
In that situation.
So they actually saw, like, there's a case where an uncle and a young boy's uncle and a young boy's and his cousin were members of one gang. And, you know, generally these kids are joining these gangs for survival because their recruitment methods are pretty strong. So
I have to play devil's advocate on this
sure.
program. I think I understand the problem here. But there are young people in American cities who face gang violence, who feel coerced into joining gangs. And if you don't join the gang, you're going to get shot. And if you do join the gang, sometimes the rite of initiation is being shot. So you're between a rock and a hard place. And yet we don't do much about that. So why should we take on the responsibility of that happening in Central America?
Well, we're really just picking up the people that flee that situation. We haven't gone down to Central America yet to fix it. But, you know, that's another show, I think, where we talk
right.
about what do we want to do with our neighboring countries and how can we help them?
President Obama warned the parents of young people in those countries not to send their children here because we will send them back. Has that had any impact on all of this? Because the media was really doing this story every single day for a couple of weeks, and now nothing. So has it had an impact? Is that why they're not doing it, or have they simply lost interest?
I think the media has a very short attention
span. Yes, we
do. But what, you know, we know that a plane load of kids was returned to one country, and so the word will get out that, hey, there is a process, and not everybody was admitted and accepted into the United States. But the question is, what does the United States want to have as its process? I mean, how are we going to continue, you know, I think, you know, immigration policy should support our, not just our economic goals, but it should reflect our values and things and experiences like freedom, tolerance, and personal liberty. So we need a system. That's all that they were talking about. And right now when they say, you know, we need to have immigration judge hear the kids, and we need to have a chance for, say, volunteer lawyers. There's no right to for a lawyer for a 12-year-old at the border.
Yeah, I want to get into that because these kids are now facing their day in court. Matter of fact, I think yesterday they began – there was a series of major of kids going through the court system, these children who have come across our border. Our laws do not mandate that they be supplied with an attorney to defend themselves or even to represent them in this court proceeding with an immigration judge. So you have unrepresented children, 4, 5, 6, 7 to 17 or 18, most of whom speak Spanish and not English, in an American court of law facing their day in court without representation. How is that American?
That's a very good question, and you've left out the part that there's a lawyer for the government. So there's a prosecuting attorney of sorts. It's called, you know, that's the government's lawyer.
We set it up that way. Why did we set it up? President Bush was trying to be, I guess, humanitarian about this when he signed this law that makes these hearings possible.
Right.
And does not immediately deport these children without a hearing. Why would that law not have provided those children with some sort of representation?
Well, I think one reason is cost, and the other reason is it's not a criminal action; it's civil. It feels pretty criminal, though. I'm sure if you're the, you know, if you're the respondent in the case, you really feel like this is worse than going to jail. I'd rather go to jail here than go back to my home country to get, you know, to get killed.
Yeah.
So we don't have that set up, but there's a lot of lawyers that are volunteering their time and energies to the kids. But first, you've got to, you know, you got to find the kids, and then you've got to have an organization to arrange things. There's all the immigration judges, I understand, from Denver, Colorado, went down to do hearings at the border. The Charlotte immigration court judges were on a phone conference the other day. I was over there on a case, and they were talking about how they were going to allocate resources. So everybody will be involved, and it's. Our system can work, but one of the things that, again, comprehensive immigration reform could fix is funding more judges, funding more attorneys, funding housing for the kids. All these things need to be looked at. We can't just say, well, just send them back, put them on buses.
And according to our laws, unaccompanied children from countries that do not border the United States, and these would be countries like El Salvador and Honduras, are placed in deportation proceedings like what are occurring now, but they cannot be sent back to their home countries until they are given that chance to appear in front of an immigration judge who will decide whether or not they can stay here. What happens to unaccompanied children who cross our border from Mexico or Canada? Not that that ever happens, but what happens to them? Do they get a hearing or do they just get sent back?
A lot of them, the Customs and Border Protection would make a summary decision, a quick decision as to they don't appear to have an asylum claim. That's not saying that Mexican kids don't have asylum claims. It just means they get handled in a different way.
Okay. And why did we set it up that way? Why do we have one set of rules for people who live in countries directly on our border versus those that have had to fight through that country to get here?
Well, I think it goes back to politics again. You know, the question is how many people have we dealt with from Mexico? What's the attitude in Congress about Mexican children coming here? You know, it's the fear of, you know, like you see if you watch any of the YouTube videos on just Google unaccompanied minors, you'll see incredibly scary, sad things of Americans on these videos, you know, dealing with buses of kids and stuff like that. So I'd say that a lot of it has to do with fear, and they've forgotten, you know, what we stand for. They've forgotten the humanitarian part.
And politics does play a big role in this, and we'll talk about the politics of the funding of all of this in a little while. But Chris in Mooresville emails, why have you not – we just started a few minutes ago, Chris, but why have you not discussed the correlation between Obama's DREAM Act and the influx in unaccompanied minors? It is an act of irresponsible journalism to not even touch on that subject. This seems like an awfully one-sided discussion. Okay, let's talk about the DREAM Act. This is the Development Relief and Education for Alien Minors Act, which permits, as I understand it, certain immigrant students who have grown up in the U.S. to apply for temporary legal status and to eventually get permanent legal status and become eligible for citizenship if they go to college or serve in the military. Did I sum that up relatively accurately?
That was very nice.
What's that got to do with this then?
Well, no, you had some shows on that as well, right. And you had some good examples of the kids that, you know, the United States could, should welcome and, you know, would benefit from. But what we ended up with, Congress couldn't, of course, agree on anything to do with the DREAM Act, so just like everything else in immigration. So we had DACA, and DACA was President Obama's program through an executive order. So DACA is not, you know, you'll hear again in the press, you'll hear that it's called amnesty. Well, it's definitely not an amnesty, but amnesty is a great word to accuse people of.
So is Chris making the point then that these kids are coming here because there are other laws that if they get here and get to stay here for a while, they'll get to stay here forever because these laws make it possible? Is that what he's saying?
What he's saying, I would think, is that things like Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the DACA program, is some kind of – that's the beacon. You know, they see that they're not going to get deported because if they fit into that statute, it's an executive order. Then they get 2 years to be here, and it can be extended, and who knows what will happen, depends on the next president.
You deal with people who've come here, adults and children, who have come here through undocumented means and who stay here, either as undocumented folks or who try to get citizenship, and you're shaking your head no. You don't deal with those people.
No.
Who are
our funding is only for people who come here legally,
that
are refugees and have refugee status, which means that they were given status when they were overseas. We do have some who have been granted asylum, and those that have been granted asylum might have come as students and applied for asylum. They might have come as visitors, or they might have come undocumented. But most of them have come not undocumented, but through as...
They've been granted refugee status overseas before they get here. How can they be undocumented?
No. Those that come here and apply for status when they're in the United States could be granted asylum. Those that are granted... what you might call asylum overseas are actually granted refugee status.
And this is what your organizations and organizations like yours throughout the country are concerned about, because you're dealing with people who have gone through some sort of channels to get here and be granted status. And it costs money to do what you do, and that money comes from, in part, from the government. And evidently, dealing with this crisis in the Southwest of undocumented, unaccompanied minors coming here in droves, that money is being diverted from programs like yours to that program. Is that, in essence, what the problem is?
That's correct. The Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is under Department of Health and Human Services, is charged with working with refugees, asylees, Cubans and parolees, human trafficking victims. So when the federal government releases these children to Office of Refugee Resettlement, they're in their custody, and therefore they're responsible to provide the services until further action is taken. Because of the surge, which has been progressively, these unaccompanied children, arrival numbers have been progressively getting worse and worse. Office of Refugee Resettlement did not have the sufficient funding to deal with this crisis. So they have redirected the funding that's used for refugees who come here and receive services such as through Catholic Charities, through Carolina Refugee Resettlement Services, and many other agencies in the area and throughout the country. They have redirected $94 million to help these children in this situation. So those dollars aren't even sufficient to help with the situation with the children. And it's creating a crisis because the refugees aren't going to have the services that they need, ones that are already here, and those that are continuing to come. So as a nation, we haven't addressed that.
The Office of Refugee Resettlement has asked Congress to increase, to promptly increase their funding and to stop what they call devastating cuts to refugee services as a result of the current crisis of undocumented, unaccompanied minors crossing the border. Last month, the president asked for $1.83 billion in more money in its $3.7 billion emergency supplemental appropriations request for 2014 to deal with this crisis. Why so much? You just talked about $94 million. He's talking about $1.83 billion. That's a big difference. Why so much?
The approximately $94 million would be replacing the $94 million that has already been diverted. Mm-hmm. The rest of the money would be for more immigration attorneys, for more immigration judges, for the border protection, and a number of the other things that people have been calling for. In whether it's in stopping this flow or in reducing the flow of the children.
How have your agencies and the people you work with been impacted thus far by this $94 million being diverted to the problem in the Southwest?
Well, what will happen, this hasn't happened yet, but what will happen is services that are provided through our agencies as well as through our partners will not be there for them. So those services are critical, comprehensive services, job search, job development services to help refugees not only get jobs but stay in jobs and become a part of our community. English as a second language courses that are provided through our community college. Services for our senior refugees to integrate them into our community through the senior centers. So there's nutritional value there. There's social adjustment values there. And then, of course, services for our refugee children who are integrated into our school system and also receive assistance from agencies in helping them academically.
Everything you just talked about are things that people who are very much opposed to all this point to as saying this is costing us far too much money and why should we take care of these people? Why they're clogging up our school systems, they're clogging up our healthcare systems, they're taking a lot of money and services. They come here undocumented, they come here illegally. I'm just repeating what they say, okay? So give me the answer to the question. I mean, we are spending a fortune on people who come here legally and illegally. Why are we doing this?
Well, I can speak a little bit about our refugees that, just to give you an example, just between our agencies, we resettle close to 600 refugees a year. And within that, we will easily locate jobs for over 700 refugees a year, and that's a conservative estimate. And when you look at the tax revenue those refugees provide here in our community, it's over $15 million a year.
Mm-hmm. Why does an organization, I don't mean to be picking on the Catholic Charities, because the Jewish contingent has their own branch of immigrant services and charities for people in need, but why should Catholic Charities or the Hebrew Charities receive government money to do charitable work? Why isn't it coming from people within your faith group?
It does come from both. There's a lot of – it's a public and private partnership. So we're able to provide extensive services because of that partnership and ongoing services because of that partnership. And we feel it's our moral obligation as well to welcome these refugees into our community and help them integrate. And they offer a lot of not only tax value but cultural value and enrichment into our communities.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of this discussion in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings, LLP, a full-service law firm advising financial institutions and investors in all types of capital markets and lending transactions. Details at babc.com. Well, on the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes, they're talking about a topic not too far away from what we're talking about. President Obama is weighing an executive order to allow millions of undocumented immigrants to avoid deportation. Some Republicans say that would be grounds for impeachment. debate over the constitutionality of executive orders discussed in 20 minutes at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our discussion, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, Facebook or Twitter will get you into the conversation. And we are coming right back.
Generations of fathers and sons have bonded over fixing cars.
The car allowed fathers to act like a man.
Then things got complicated.
Most cars don't have dipsticks anymore, so you can't drink a six-pack with your friends and change the oil in front of your house.
Fatherhood and the demise of home car repair. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 till 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about immigration. We're particularly talking about the problem on the southwestern border with the flood of unaccompanied minors recently coming into our country, seeking asylum from what they fear is their imminent demise in their native countries. With Ellen Dubin, who's executive director of the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency, Sarah Ponce, who's director of Catholic Charities of Charlotte Diocese Resettlement Program, Alan Gordon, who's an attorney in immigration law. The Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency, explain what that is.
It's the successor agency to Hyas North Carolina. Hyas North Carolina was started in 1996.
And Hyas is an acronym for what?
Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society.
Okay.
And that was started in 1996 as a wholly owned subsidiary of Hyas. But on the board of directors, after several years of Hyas North Carolina's existence, the board of directors of Hyas had rewritten their strategic plan. And as a result of that, basically I was given the choice of totally closing up shop or else starting my own resettlement agency, which is what I've done. And I've chosen the name Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency because it says exactly what it is that we do.
How many – because you're not talking about – and you corrected me, so I'm glad you did. You're not talking about people who come here in the dead of night sneaking over the border with a coyote for the most part. You're talking about people who apply for refugee status,
yes,
are granted it, come here, and then you help find them a place to settle and live and help find them a job, etc.
Yes.
So they end up paying taxes, and they pay into the Social Security system,
yes,
and all that sort of stuff. How many people do you serve at both of these organizations? Because you're just two of many organizations. How many refugees do we have legitimately coming into the country every year?
Nationally, the goal for this year is 70,000.
And where are they coming from, and what are they fleeing from?
Well, in order to get refugee status, they have to have proven a well-founded fear of persecution if they were to return to their home countries.
What parts of the world are they coming from?
They're coming from a variety of countries, but most of them right now are Bhutan, Burma, Iraq, and several nations in Africa, most specifically Congo.
Mm-hmm. So your concern in all of this is that you don't want to lose the funding, the $94 million, which is being diverted to the Southwest.
And I also just understand the $94 million is national. It's
right,
not
I understand.
Just here in Charlotte.
And many people feel, as you do, that they need to devote more or appropriate more money for the situation in the Southwest as opposed to just taking it from robbing Peter to pay Paul, essentially. I'm not sure I have a question here, except for the fact that what do you think should happen? And how many people are in your corner? And because this is a political hot potato.
I was going to say, I don't know how many are in our corner.
Uh-huh.
But as far as what we think should happen, and I think I speak for Sierra as well as for Alan, that there should be comprehensive immigration reform. That's a little more long-term, I suppose. Short-term is that And this is a political hot potato, I know that, but money of funds should be allocated to the refugee resettlement as well as to the humanitarian needs of these unaccompanied minors.
We've talked many times, Alan, about the need, and you're not the only guest who's been on this program talking about the need for immigration reform and the fact that the immigration system is broken, and people within the government will say the immigration system is broken. People in the Congress, Republicans and Democrats, will say that the immigration system is broken. It is clear now that the immigration system is terribly broken, and it's costing us a ton of money as we vacillate about what to do to fix it. Does anybody have a clear idea on what to do to fix it?
Well, first, I'd like to say I'm glad that everybody agrees on something. This could be the first time. I think there's a lot of propositions. There's a lot of really bright people that work for senators and congressmen in the United States that have put together incredibly detailed plans. They haven't been discussed. They haven't been voted on, of course, but they haven't even been discussed or put out to the American people.
Is that because the whole idea of immigration, when we hear the word in 21st century America, immigration, we automatically think of illegal immigration. We've never liked immigration, despite the fact that we all came from somewhere. Every group that came here, the Irish, the Italians, the Germans, every group who came here was disliked when they arrived because they were immigrants. And most of them came through Ellis Island, through channels, and made great sacrifices to come here. We just didn't like them until they assimilated and became American. But now these illegal immigrants, of which we've had a lot, although they do all the stuff that we don't want to do, and they do it cheaply, we don't want them here either.
Right, and even Benjamin Franklin had one immigrant group that he picked on too. So, even my hero.
So is that why we can't discuss this? Is that why these plans that you allude to, sitting in file cabinets in Congress's offices, can't be broken out and talked about because it's just too much red meat?
Well, I think they can be, and I think there's always going to be people on both sides, or there's always going to be some racism. There's always going to be some it's us and them. But we've had immigration reform in the past, and we've had it under Reagan, of course. There's a lot of people that are upset that we had amnesty, but it was a Reagan policy, and that was the law that Congress agreed to. You have to go back to what is immigration.
Well, that's another thing that people point to, and I'll let you say what is immigration and what's American and all that sort of stuff. But people point to things like the Reagan Amnesty Program and President Obama's Dream Act as saying to everybody in the rest of the world, "Come here, there'll be no consequences."
Yes, and that's not true. I mean, there's another thing they say is that there's no enforcement of immigration law under Obama. Well, since Obama became president, he surprised a lot of people that paid attention to the numbers. Over 400,000 people were removed under Obama's in his first term,
more than in the Bush administration.
Oh, in the Bush administration, I think it was well under 100,000.
Okay,
so he was enforcing the law, but he doesn't have a good press agent, obviously. So a lot of people have gotten deported, and it happens. But a lot of people are entitled to refugee status, and a lot of people are entitled to asylum status, and a lot of people are entitled to family reunification through their spouses and their kids.
Pete emails, obviously, your guests are kind-hearted Americans with vested interests who think these kids, the ones on the southwest border, should be granted asylum. Have you ever seen a case with these unaccompanied kids that you felt should not be granted? I've been to Honduras several times. There are millions of these kids. How many should be able to come here?
Well, I have seen cases where, they were denied asylum by the judge. And, even if we did it, when we did an appeal, not all appeals were successful. So, and there's cases that we're reading. The Fourth Circuit came down recently, and the Fourth Circuit happens to be where we are. So the Fourth Circuit in Richmond has control over North Carolina. And we see that, they, on one hand, they've expanded the reasonable fear of, of a social group to that domestic violence and things like that. And then on the other hand, they are restrictive on other things. So it's not everybody's getting a free ride here.
And we've talked a lot about money, but it's not just about money, this situation in the Southwest. An official with the UN High Commission on Refugees says this is not a migration story, not an immigration story. This is a humanitarian crisis. and your organizations, the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency, Catholic Charities, etc., as well as many others, are urging us to live up to our principles to create a holistic approach that closes the gaps in our immigration policy and our borders while also providing sanctuary for refugees, particularly these unaccompanied children. How do you explain the harsh reaction we've witnessed in some places in this country to busloads of children just being transported from one place to another with picketers turning the buses around? How do you explain that?
Again, I think it's politics. And it's just become such a hot political issue. But and a lot of the focus, and in many ways, rightly so, has been on these unaccompanied minors. But we're here today, and the purpose that we came here today was to talk about the issues with the refugees and right. how the refugees, those that have been waiting in line, had gone through all kinds of vetting procedures, did come here legally, and then the services that they're going to lose. And that's what I'd like to focus on.
Well, that's also very political, because people talk about being angry with our helping and aiding undocumented aliens when we have people who have taken the time to obey our laws and fill out the paperwork and the years that it takes to do that to come here, be they refugees or immigration, coming in here for other reasons. So why should we help these people? And yet Congress, you're saying, is helping those people, the other people, by giving your money to them. Do they have an alternative? You know what I'm saying? You're saying that the money's being diverted to it's political that people don't mind so much helping people come here who have gone through channels. They don't like the people who don't go through channels because they've broken our laws to come here. And yet the money that you're talking about, the $94 million, is leaving you to go to help the people who haven't come here through legal channels. That seems to be perversely political.
Well, that's not really what's going on, but it does seem perverse. There, you know, when you say, you know, the unaccompanied minors, these kids that are coming to our southern border, you know, the money's going to go to them. Well, first of all, the money's going to the United States government so that we can get some more judges and some more facilities so that we can make a fair and reasonable determination. Remember, we are a nation of laws, mm-hmm. you know, but we might not all like all the laws, but we are a nation of laws. And so we're going to give them a hearing. We're going to let them have an opportunity to get some help so that they can explain what happened in their home country and why their mothers put them on a month and a half walk to the southern border of the United States. And if they have an asylum claim, then they should have the opportunity to present it. Now, how does an 8-year-old present that? I don't know. My 8-year-old kids, when they were 8, they were pretty verbal, but you know, they didn't speak English if they were Spanish speaking. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the kind of problem where, you know, that's where the money's going. It's really not going to just let them in. It's going to determine who should be allowed here, who should be given asylum.
Are you? What's going on with your agencies and the Congress to convince them to not do what they're doing and to give more money to the people who actually come here through channels?
Well, we've had several conference calls with varying members of Congress and the senators. And I believe that other resettlement agencies, not only throughout the state but throughout the country, have been having conversations. Unfortunately, usually it's with a staffer, not with the congressman or the senator, him or herself. And so we don't know for sure what message is going through to the voting person.
The Hebrew Immigrant Society published a coordinated statement of various Jewish organizations, which calls this something that is crucial to deal with. It is crucial that we deal with this urgent humanitarian situation while maintaining our country's commitment to asylum seekers and refugees. Obviously, your people feel that this is urgent. Do the Congress people, the people that make these decisions, view it the same way? Are they getting messages like that through? Are those messages going through to Congress, I guess is the question here.
I think some do, but again, there's so many issues that they're dealing with. aside from this that I don't think it's necessarily getting the attention that it needs to be getting.
And talk to me about why this is so urgent. What will happen if this doesn't happen, if they don't take action, if they continue to divert money? What happens?
Well, they haven't really resolved the situation of the children. You know, they haven't come up with a long-term process of how to help these children that are here, whether they're going to stay here or have to go back.
But, I mean, what happens to your people, the people who have come through channels and who have been settled here because we decided they have a right to be here and we want them here, and you need the money to help them stay here and thrive here. So what happens if we don't solve this problem?
Well, they'll have to depend on other agencies here in the community that are not set up necessarily to provide the comprehensive case management services that our agencies provide, the additional academic support that we can provide to our children here, our refugee children. They're going to have to try to figure out on their own how to deal with a very complex system while they have very limited language, because there won't even be English as a second language provided to them.
Basically, cutting to the chase, we're going to have to reduce staff. And as a result of reducing staff, there won't be the services available, certainly not through our agency, to the refugees. It will also mean that with cutting staff, that some of our staff members will be collecting unemployment insurance, which will be a draw on the state funds. Some of them might be going on welfare themselves, which certainly will be a draw on the state funds. But in addition to our relatively small staffs and what will happen to them, what is going to happen to the refugees is they won't be able to find and maintain the jobs that they have now. As Sarah had said, between the two agencies in the past year, both agencies combined, through the jobs that we found for our clients, they contributed more than $15 million to the local economy. That won't happen anymore.
So once again, the problems that we can't solve at the national level end up being problems at the local level that we probably pay a lot more for than we need to if we just fix things that need to be fixed.
Exactly.
Ellen Dubin, Executive Director of the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency, Sarah Ponce, Director of Catholic Charities, Charlotte Resettlement Program, and Alan Gordon, Immigration Law Attorney. Thanks for the hour. Charlotte.